Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Javon Wooden. Javon is the founder of Bright Mind Consulting Group. He's an Army veteran and a Bronze Star recipient. He's a speaker, he's an author, and he's here today to walk us through how he works with leaders and leadership teams to build resilience, strategic thinking, empathetic-based leadership skills, and more. This is a conversation full of energy, full of insights. It's a great conversation, and I'm really excited to share it with all of you today. He's going to get into some of the lessons that he learned as a non-commissioned officer in the Army and how those lessons translate directly to business leadership going both up and down the org chart. He's going to talk about how sometimes it feels like you're translating languages as you go up and down the org chart, how he does that, how he works with other organizations to do it. He's going to go through his 5-Y framework. That's the letter Y, not the word Y. And he's going to talk about the role that trust plays in the important art of delegation. It really is an awesome, fun, engaging conversation. He brings tons of energy. I'm excited to share it with you all. Thank you very much for being here for another episode. Please, while you're here, take just a second, like the show, share it, subscribe to the show. We really appreciate it. And of course, please head out online and check out our sponsors when you have a chance as well. Head out to humantel.com. That's where you can enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training to identify when people's emotions are changing through shifts in their facial expressions and body language. I've done it all myself. I highly recommend it. That's over at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can get all your questions answered on the International Association of Interviewers. You can learn all the benefits of membership, the networking opportunities, all you can contribute to the organization. That's also where you can learn everything you need to know about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies? How do you earn it? What could it mean for your career moving forward over at certifiedinterviewer.com? And while you're online, thank you for checking out INQUASIVE.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques necessary to uncover hidden value in all of their high-impact conversations. We really appreciate you being here for another episode. Thank you so much. So now, without further ado, we introduce to you Javon Wooden. Good morning, Javon. It is great to meet you. Thank you for being here today. How are you?
Good morning, Michael. I'm doing well, man. Look, I'm listening forward to this conversation. I know it's going to be a great one.
Well, I really appreciate you being here. Like I said, it's a pleasure to meet you, getting ready for the conversation. I'm really excited for some of the topics we can get into. Who knows where we're going to go? I like just being able to dive in. So we're talking a little bit offline before we got started. Anytime I talk to somebody about their military experience, I always like to preempt it by saying, I did not serve, so I don't want anybody getting the message confused. Certainly, thank you for your service. I didn't serve. From what little bit I know about your background, you served as a non-commissioned officer in the Army. And the dangerous understanding I have of that type of position is that you're caught in the middle. Up the food chain or chain of command are coming down on you. People from below the chain of command are coming up on you. Peers from either side. So looking at what you do now is you really work to educate leaders in the business world. I'd love to start the conversation by asking, what are some of the biggest lessons that you learned as an NCO that you carry forward today as you educate business leaders?
Oh, man, that's a great question. That's one we can have a whole podcast episode on just that, but I'll try to make it succinct, man.
Go, man. The microphone's yours.
Yes, absolutely. So the first lesson I learned is, you know, communication has to be paramount because, as you said, we are getting it from the bottom. We know what's happening on the front line, and then we're also getting instruction and strategy from the top. So we need to be able to synthesize that and communicate it in both languages, because both of those communicate differently, right? The bottom has a different lesson, different experiences, so we need to convey it in their way. And then the top, they need to know what's going on so they can make the best decisions. But also, I need to be able to say, hey, that's not going to work because, and do it in their way. Or, hey, here's what we're learning from the field. You know, here's some information that you can use for your strategy as we move forward. So that's one. The second one is patience, right? We have a saying in the Army that was stay flexible. And I used to hate it when we said it while I was in. But then afterwards, when I really thought about that, I'm like, huh, that's actually profound. Because if you think about it, you can plan all you want in the Army, but that doesn't mean your mission is going to go according to plan. More likely than not, it's not. So you have to make sure that you're staying flexible and not so focused on the outcome going the way you want it to go. You need to be able to adjust and have contingency plans in place. Understand, you know, when you can pivot and how you can pivot. Understand the capabilities of your team. All these things going into that staying flexible and not being so tied to the outcome. The other message that I want to convey to the listeners from the military is this idea that you do not have to have all the answers. In the military, it's a very collective effort. So if I am the non-commissioned officer in charge and I have my squad or my team with me, I need to be able to listen to them to say, okay, what do you think, right? And we do this thing, we do something before where we strategize, but we also do something after the mission that's called the after action report, where we get everyone together and say, hey, what was supposed to happen? What actually happened? What went well? And what can we adjust as we move forward? And we get everyone's opinion on that. Feedback is very important. And I feel like this is somewhere where a lot of organizations are missing, because what they do is they wait for that annual review. And that annual review is probably asking the same questions every year. That's not giving people a chance to really convey their experiences, how they think that we should move forward, making room for innovation and making room for that open dialogue that is very beneficial, that as I've seen in the military.
And you're right. We could have an entire podcast conversation on that answer alone.
I was like, let me just do three, because I can go all day on that one.
But dude, there's so much there in those three. So I'm going to try to go in order and we'll see if we end up coming back to all three or where we go as the conversation goes on. But when you talked about communications being paramount, I think to some level, we all know that, and myself included, we struggle to actually like be consistent with that as situations change and the people we have to communicate change. But something I really love that you said in there was learning how to speak two languages. Like, coincidentally, they're both English, but they're two different languages depending on who you're talking to. In this case, one might be more strategic, one might be more tactical. Yes. So for people who are listening, and again, dude, correct me on anything I say that you're like, ah, actually, not quite. You're never going to hurt my feelings.
I got you.
But when I think about the NCO role, I think about somebody who is somewhere in those middle to upper middle levels of management in an organization is kind of a reasonable comparison. I think, although we shouldn't do it, when push comes to shove, you can always look down the org chart or chain of command and say, just do it. I mean, hopefully we don't, but if we have to, we have to. We don't have that luxury as we're speaking up the chain of command or up the org chart. So as you were looking to speak the truth or help influence the decisions at the strategic level, how did you learn to influence people up the chain of command who traditionally or maybe stereotypically, again, I could be way off base here, might not necessarily be as open to influence and outside opinions?
Yeah, absolutely. And this, I'm glad you're bringing this up, because it happens in the military, it happens in the corporate space. Hell, it happens in life, right? Where you have someone you need to influence that may be making that final decision. So one of the things I always coach people on these days is the fact of managing up. And when you manage up, you have to find what they care about, right? And why does it matter to them? And what I love to do is I try to find two things that they'll care about. One, the business reason. Right? Why is it important from a business aspect? But most importantly, why is it important for a personal aspect? So what does that do for them? Is it giving them more time? Do they have a bonus tied to the outcome? You know, what is it about that thing? So once you can find that out, then whatever you're looking to influence them on, your presentation has to include those things, right? For instance, if I'm saying I need more headcount, if I'm saying I need to bring someone else on, well, what is that person going to do? How is it going to impact that business goal? How is it going to impact it positively, I should add? And then what is it going to do for them from a personal standpoint? How does it make them look better? How does it give them more time? How does it help them from a financial aspect? How does it do whatever it is that they care about? And that's how you're going to really influence. Because remember, influence is really leadership. We're not looking to change everything that they're thinking about, but we're looking to cause them a little shift in what they find important and how we can help them achieve that goal. And once you do that, now you can have the conversation. You may need more information, and here's that communication again, right? Everyone communicates differently. So we also need to know their audience. Do they want all the facts, or do they just want the bottom line up front? Do they want you to just get straight to the point? So once you know that, you communicate in that way and you convey it. And that's how I like to coach people on making sure that they're influencing that top. And then you can just, it's really about starting that conversation. You may not, you may have to keep coming back. But once you get that information on what they're looking for, now you can start playing that game.
That's a great answer, man. So much value in there. I love how you talk about, I guess my words, not yours, but studying how they make decisions. Like, how do they like the information presented to them? Give it to them in their language. Do they need all the facts? Do they just want to know? For a while, I worked with a guy who used to say, tell me how the movie ends and I'll tell you if I want to hear the movie.
Like, there you go.
Not saying I love the approach, but hey, now I know. So I know how to frame the conversation as we're moving forward. And you said something a little bit at the end there that might've skipped over, but it's the follow-up. I think all too often you mentioned like influence and leadership can be interchangeable, of course. But when people talk about how do I influence somebody, it's almost like they're looking for a hack, a card trick. Like, what's the one thing I need to say? What's the one thing I need to do? Brother, that doesn't exist. Like, it's going to be more than one conversation. It's going to happen over time. It can be like turning a ratchet wrench or playing a chess game, whatever analogy you want to use as we put people in place to make the decision. So all great insight there, man. I appreciate it.
Appreciate that.
So now let's go the other way. Let's talk translating English to English. You're stuck in the middle.
I love it.
You've got the I was going to say orders, message, communication strategy, whatever, coming down from the top. And now you've got to deliver it down to your team, your group. I'm sure there's some overlap in the answer, of course. But how do you work to translate? And again, if I'm saying this wrong, call me on it.
No,
the strategic to the tactical so people get the message and understand how to execute.
Yeah, again, you synthesize and what's important for them to know. Like, what are the facts that they need? Because they're not going to need that whole big picture all the time. So you're going to say, you're going to break it down. So if I have my team, I'm going to say, all right, here's the orders, right? This is the summary of what we're looking to do, because I want to put that goal first so they can process it from whatever is important for their job and their roles. So we're going to say, okay, and then I'm going to stage it. So I'm going to say, here's the goal. Here's what we're going to do first. Here's how we're going to execute. Here's when we're going to execute. And then here's why it's important for us to execute. I always throw that why in, because oftentimes when we're in that leadership role, we just like, hey, we got to do it. But that's not enough for a lot of people. So I need to be able to say, hey, it's important for us to do this because of X reason. Here's how it impacts you as the soldier or as the employee, as the person carrying out this mission. And then I'm going to make room for questions because I want to make sure that there's clarity. I'm not just going to say, hey, you got it? Good. No, I'm going to say, all right, any questions about this? Was I clear enough? Because I know that I can't sit there and assume that everyone got it on that first try. Again, everyone learns differently. So once I do that and I open that dialogue, make that space, even if someone says, I don't have any questions, then I know some people have to take some things in process or they have to get to work to see what comes up. So I'm going to make room. I'm going to check in again and say, hey, everyone good? I know it's been a day. How you feeling about it? Are we on track? Do you need any further instruction? Is there anything I can support you with? And that's really the role of the leader, that support. That's the difference between a manager and a leader. A leader is going to support that person to ensure that they have that long-term goal hit. A manager is only focused on that short-term, getting that outcome, that process, and making sure that's running well. Right? They're not really too concerned about how the people run it and do it, but they just know that they need to get it done. But I feel like we have to have both of those skill sets.
Again, great response. And I love how you talk about stages, your word, staging it around the goal. Like,
yes.
Oftentimes I feel, and you mentioned too, people don't learn it the first time.
Right.
It's, and I'm sure you've seen this with everything that you do, whether I'm coaching youth sports or coaching executives, it's funny watching people get frustrated when their audience didn't get it the first time. Like, your expectation was this 8-year-old kid in front of you or whatever, this 40-year-old employee in front of you, you're going to tell them once and they were going to completely understand what to do and how to do it to your expectations. Yeah. Like, that's not how life works. Let's get out of the entitlement trap here. So I love how you're talking about making room for questions, making sure, like, are we clear? Did we get it across the right way, following up with people, all great points. And that first answer you said is, I'm trying not to forget all of the great points you made as we go through here.
You have a great memory. I'm like, man, I'm jealous a little bit, man. I'm like, God dang, how's he be picking it up? That's good.
You're making me work today, man. I love it. So you talked about the importance of patience and staying flexible. And my bias, I love both of those. My bias, I feel like if we just talk about listening for a second, patience is likely the single most important skill related to listening. If I can be patient and give myself a reason to care, I'll listen. If I can't, I won't.
Yeah.
I guess from the outside looking in, it's a little bit funny or ironic to hear the military talk about being flexible. I can certainly understand how those go together, but maybe on the surface, it doesn't always feel that way. Everybody who actually served is telling me to shut up. I don't know what I'm talking about. I get it. I get it.
No, some of them are probably like, yeah, it is. It feels oxymoronic, but it's true.
So one of the things, and you said it in there a little bit too, as I try to tie this all together before I further embarrass myself, is separating the process from the outcome. Like, we know the outcome we need to achieve, but we can be flexible in the process that we use in order to get there. Mm-hmm. So drawing from your experience, and you can take this any way you want, man, military, civilian, both, whatever works well for you, but how do you help leaders maintain that sense of flexibility within the process in order to achieve that final outcome or next stage outcome that's important to them?
Yeah, and it goes back to that why. The why is the foundation of everything. So if a goal is important for a reason deeper than just a monetary gain, chances are we're willing to do some solutioning. Because what happens is, if we don't think about that first, if we don't really understand why it's important for us to hit said goal, then we start to lose sight as we go along. And then also, if you don't set the why, maybe it's just an aspirational thing that is not necessarily needed at the time. Maybe it's a want. So then you start to look at that goal differently. And why that's important is, if we need that goal, we're going to plan out really, really deeply. And we're going to identify contingencies. We're going to set milestones to understand how close or far away we are. We're going to make sure the resources are necessary. And we're going to do more checking in, right? Because it's that important. But also, if you really need that goal, what you're going to do if you do start to stray away a little bit is you're going to be more willing to get insight from external sources. So a lot of times as leaders, we make these decisions in a silo. But you can't do that if you really need that thing to happen. You have to have a leadership team. That leadership team needs to be tied into their people, understand what's possible, like all these things. And it creates this checklist that goes all the way down, hopefully, if you're doing it right. But if it's a want goal, then you understand that you probably never hit that goal before. And it's more of an aspirational thing. So you're more willing to learn as you go. And that's one of the things we did in the military, right? Even if it's a aspirational goal, we didn't just come out, for instance, new technology. We had to fail a lot. We had to test a lot before we knew the technology worked, or even our processes and systems that we indoctrinated, right? Those things are indoctrinated because we did it over and over and over again. We failed a whole bunch of times before it went into that book that says field manual FM-60 or whatever it is, right? So companies, they don't have that right now. A lot of them are like, hey, we're setting this goal of doubling our revenue every year. And it's like, what does that entail? Because it sounds great, but what does it really entail? And you got to go back to talking to your people and really figuring out if it's possible in that way. And that's why I created my 5-why framework, really. And what we're talking about here is the first why, when we're going to that yardstick, setting a goal, but understanding the clear vision and purpose behind the goal, not just for you as the leader, but being able to convey that and why it matters for your people and how it's going to impact them. And then going to that second why, which is the yield, and saying, okay, do we have the resources necessary? Do we need more manpower? Does our people need more training? Does it fit our culture? Those checks just do not happen in corporations. And that's why, whether it's a needed goal or a want goal, they're starting to fall short and they're getting flustered. And then we're starting to see all the things that leads to, right? These layoffs and everything, because they were too aspirational and they didn't really have that clear vision and purpose.
All right, now you're testing the hell out of my memory, because I got a bunch I want to talk about. But you said you got a 5-why framework. You left me hanging at 2. What are the next 3 whys? And then we'll come back to them.
Let's do it. I had to leave you because I wanted to make sure I paused. I was like, I'm giving a lot. We gotta pause for a minute, digest what's going on. Listeners,
if this is your show. You're good. You're good. What are the next three whys?
So the next three whys. So the third one is actually YAR. It's a boating term, and it's about ease, making change easier. In fact, every goal, everything we're doing is a component of change or some type of change, right? So the YAR is making it easier. And then the fourth why is yoga. When I thought of a yogi as I created this framework, I thought of someone who was strong and graceful in difficult situations. So we want to do that as an individual and as organizations. The fifth why is what we call yearn. That's really getting people to evangelize what you're looking to do. That's where that influence really comes into play. So from an organizational standpoint, that means your customers are writing those testimonials. They're referring you to other people. Your employees are willing to say how great it is to work for you. They're posting about your events, those types of things. And then from a people standpoint, maybe you have some friends that's always chopping you up. They're sponsoring you in rooms you're not in. So that's really where we want to get to. And then you keep that cycle going.
All right, so we're going to circle back to that. I promise.
Let's do it.
We're going to circle all the way back. But you said so much in that answer that I just want to highlight in case people are taking notes and maybe it slipped past a little bit. But you said three things to start with that, from my perspective, are extremely important. And you called out, you know, management organization might not always be considering milestones, resources, and checking in. Let's start there. Like, if we're going to go on a mission, on a journey, if we're going to go on this change, whatever it is, we want to, you know, you gave the example of double our revenue. Okay, cool. What are our milestones? Like, at what point, like, where should we be by when? And
yes,
when are we checking in on those milestones to say, like my little boy, are we there yet? What's working well? What's not working well? Do we need to adjust? Can we actually get there faster? Do we need to maybe set our expectations back a little bit? So, and then the resources. How many, now, I guess in fairness, all the necessary resources aren't going to always be available, which ties back to being flexible and being grace, or having grace in difficult situations and some of the other things that you mentioned. But are we doing our best to give our people the available resources that they need to be successful? Or are we basically just tapping them on the shoulder and saying, figure it out, you're responsible for it, whether it's impossible or not? And those check-ins, those conversations that you're having as well, super important. You said one word in there that I want to get back to. As soon as you said it, I had to bite through both sides of my face so I didn't cut you off. Solutioning.
Yes.
What do you mean by solutioning?
So in this case, so I talk about this often, how oftentimes we're talking about problem solving. Right? And problem solving, what do you look at first? You look at the problem, and often we get stuck there. And that's why I'm careful to say solutioning, right? A lot of consulting firms say this word. Solutioning is a way where you're like, okay, we have this thing in front of us, but we're not so focused on the issue that we can't see our options, right? So that's just brainstorming, you know, whatever you need to do, whatever your process is, but getting external viewpoints to say, all right, here's my problem. What do you think? What do you think? And you're coming together on a common goal so you can see what's better. And then you have the process of synthesizing those down to say, all right, this may not work. Why doesn't it work? Right? This may work. Let's test this one out. And you can put them in buckets. So that way, as you're moving closer to the whatever that solution is, you're willing to be at a check back and you already have a bucket of things that you can do. And it's really a way of creating that contingency plan. All right, if we try this out and it doesn't go the way we want to try it, then what? And it's also a way where you're not pointing fingers. All right, this problem happened because John did it. So what? Well, all right, we still have to solve it. So let's come together. How did the problem occur? If we know, right? That's one of the first things to solutioning. Do we know what the root cause is? If we don't, can we figure out the root cause? Because if you can figure that out, you won't diagnose the wrong solution to the issue. And that's one of the things like we move too quickly on. So that's why I like to say solution instead of problem solve. We're not so caught up on who did what to cause the problem. We're more focused on what's our options moving forward from this point going.
Amen, dude. I'm not aware of one single problem that's ever been solved through blame.
No,
it doesn't happen. We can make things worse a lot faster, but I'm not aware of any time blame has actually helped solve a problem.
I don't think it happened in the history of history.
It probably hasn't. And I do like again, my personal bias, I feel like the people who can pivot the quickest from problem solving to solution creation are the ones who are going to be the most successful in most situations. So I love the fact that you refer to it as solutioning. And we're not giving any of those other consulting companies credit for using the terms. I heard it from you first. You get the credit. That's the way it's going to go.
Appreciate you, man.
It's what I'm here for. But even in that, and it ties into some of the other things you said before, like leaders don't need to have all the answers. Is it really failure or is it iteration? Are we working through these different ideas in order to work towards the best way forward? Again, separating the process from the outcome, working towards what's best, regardless of who gets the credit or how we get there. And to work on the circle to get back to your five whys, that third thing you mentioned back in the beginning of the conversation was we don't need to have all the answers. And a lot of what you've talked about since then is keeping the conversation open, asking questions, checking in, following up, solutioning, failing, all of these things. When I listen to that, I hear a thread of humility, I guess two threads, humility and self, three. I'm going to make this up as I go. Three threads, humility, self-awareness, and self-confidence. I feel like in order to feel like it's cool, I don't have all the answers and go get help, there has to be a real level of self-confidence that we can get through the ego wall and actually seek those answers out, which leads to the humility and the self-awareness is probably all tied in. So probably a two-part question, but I'll start here first. How did you learn to develop that trait of humility / self-confidence to make it okay to go to people that might look to you for the answers and say, actually, what do you think we should do?
Yeah, and I just got to say, you're really good at this, man. You're able to like process everything and like come up with these real succinct, concise answers and questions. So, man, kudos to you on that. So for me, you know, that humility, that self-confidence, it really, when I think about it all, emotional intelligence, we talk about it a lot, but it's foundational to what we're talking about here today, because that first pillar of emotional intelligence is self-awareness. So for me, I did a lot of intrinsic work. I had to ask myself the tough questions, and I didn't just do it by myself. I got feedback from others. So I let them know, like, hey, I have a goal of being a better leader, a better listener. I know sometimes I can just spew the answer at you. I want to be able to ask more questions. I want to have coaching conversations. I need your help with that. And that's really what has helped me get to this level. Not only did I go through coach training to start asking those questions, but I also was willing to get that help from other people, people's opinion I value, my soldiers when I was in the military. So that's what I feel like everyone else should do is just be willing to say, I don't have all the answers, but I want to be better. And to be better, we need support. And to get that support, it starts with us. Right? So we have to be vulnerable enough to say, where are my blind spots? Where are my triggers? Where can I have room for improvement that I really want to improve on? And then let me ask someone if they can be support, not just accountability partners, but really like actively assisting me in this thing, not just asking me, how's it going? So that's where I think everyone should start on. You know, if they want to be more humble, they want to have that self-confidence and self-awareness, it really starts internally to just do that work. And then the other part is not comparing, right? Comparison is something that is easier said than done, especially in this world when we have social media and everything's right in front of us. We have to be willing to kind of disengage, right? Not personalize everything that we see and hear, and then really be like, okay, what is the lessons I can learn from that? Is this my goal or is this something that's important for me or is it not? Because if it's not, what happens is you start pacing yourself in a way to try to achieve something that doesn't even really matter. And that impacts your self-confidence because it wasn't something you should have been going for or believing in the first place. So those are the two that really I focus in and day out on. And then the third thing is I do a lot of checking in at the end of my day. So oftentimes we as people, we focus on negatives more than we do positives and it weighs on us more. So one of the things I do is, how did my day go outside of journaling and writing down key points? How did it go? And I'll score it from 1 to 10. And what I'll score it before I even filter out all that went on, I'll say it's an 8 or a 7. And then I'll go why. And I'll say, what was that one thing that brought it down from a 10 to a 7? And then that allows us to do that introspective work to say, how did that impact the rest of what I was doing? Because again, it's that self-awareness that we're working on. And that's where all the other things are coming in from. Because once we become self-aware, we're aware of how we are positioned and presenting ourselves externally. And then that will allow us to have that social component where empathy comes in so we can listen, so we can be better leaders, so we can understand that we don't have to have all the answers and just remain curious.
How many nails did you just hit on the head in like a 3-minute answer, man? And even just to kind of go backwards there, the ability to remain curious, the ability to remain in that learning mentality. Like for me, I feel like that level of self-awareness that you just illustrated is a rare commodity. I mean, I can only speak from my perspective. And again, people can roll their eyes and agree or disagree, and they're probably valid in whatever point or perspective they have. But I feel like if I was to categorize people I meet on a regular basis, there would be many more in the not self-aware bucket than the actually self-aware bucket. And then there would be a fair amount in the not self-aware bucket who probably think they are to some degree, yeah, but unfortunately aren't. And there might be people that think that way of me, by the way. I mean, I could definitely be in a glass house throwing some stones here. So let me put guardrails on my hypocrisy if I can real quick. But that level of humility, I do think is rare. I like the way that you look at it. And even like you're doing your own personal after action reports. And even when you talked about those earlier, there was an interesting kind of designation that I thought I heard you make in there. That was when you're talking about the after action reports, you know, what did we expect to happen and what actually happened?
Yes.
Those can be two different things. And if we don't stop to break that apart, we can end up thinking what we expected to happen was actually what happened because that's what we thought was going on. That comparison piece is super important too. And that's something that as a dad, I feel like I struggle with my son because I want him to grow up and be competitive, right? But there's a difference between healthy competition and unhealthy comparison. So as he plays on different sports teams and he develops academically and does different things, like trying to work with him to find that healthy level of comparison. So to steal a word you used earlier, he's got benchmarks or areas of comparison, motivation for growth, but I don't ever want him hanging his head saying, well, I'm not as good as that kid, or I'm not as good like sports. He plays 4 or 5 different sports. Now he's in elementary school. So he's learning to play 4 or 5 different sports, but in each one of those sports, there's kids that only play that sport.
Right.
So at this age, they're so much better than everybody else. Like, I don't want that to be discouraging. Like, dude, the life skills you're learning by learning how to play all these sports, in one selfish dad's opinion, is way better than only playing one sport. So don't compare yourself against that kid, because in 5 years, that math is going to change.
Yes, indeed.
Kids are going to grow up differently. Those skills are going to translate differently. So it's all great points. One more piece on the humility. I'd love to get your respect. I just gave away the question that I'm going.
Oh, you got that. respect already. Well,
thank you. But your opinion on respect is really where I'm going. Your respect is important to me, but that wasn't the question I was going to ask. So when you think about it, both from a military and like a civilian or business leadership perspective, I feel like a lot of times when people feel like they have to have all the answers, it could be a fear-driven response or a field-driven decision, because I need to be respected. And if people don't feel like I have the answers, then they won't respect me. I'm curious, again, as always, correct me if you disagree in any way, through your experience, both in the military and coaching leaders in the civilian and business world, how have you seen when leaders cop to not having the answers? How have you seen that actually impact the respect that others have for them?
Anytime I've seen a leader admit that they need help finding the answer, or that they don't, or they'll go figure it out, that just breeds more respect. Every time I've seen it, it's like, all right, team, we have this thing in front of us. I do not know where we should go with this. What are your thoughts? I think that is something for me that stands for what the military stands for. So we have these values, and one of them is integrity. That speaks to integrity when you can say as a leader, this is not my wheelhouse, right? I hope that someone around here, because we have all these different experiences from an educational and life standpoint, hopefully we can all figure this out together. And people will respect you for that for a number of reasons. One, if you find out someone does have experience with that, they would more be more inclined to take ownership of that thing. And that gives them a chance to shine. And as a leader, you should be looking for those opportunities to give other people that chance to step up and step in and lead things and get ownership of it. And then it also allows the others, if they don't have experience with it, to do some meaningful work and to learn something else through a challenge. So saying that just opens the door for so much growth for everyone involved that it should be said more. And you may not say, I don't know. You may just ask, you know what? I realize that I'm always looking to just spew out what I think. I want to know what you think before I even jade your answer or have you look through my pane of glass. I want to get your perspectives. You can say it that way, and that's going to open up. You'll be surprised what comes. So I think that that's something that really, really could be a useful tool if you're talking about team growth, organizational development type of pieces.
I couldn't agree more. And I think especially too as leaders, if we ask somebody their idea, their alternative, their preference, and whether it's exactly what we wanted or close enough or maybe a different road, but at least to the same outcome, just accepting that, like it's their credit, it's their idea. It's their, you talked about ownership, but then you talk about the self-confidence and the not problem solving, solutioning confidence that comes from that after. I couldn't agree more. I feel like we earn more respect when we are more humble, self-effacing, looking for help as opposed to putting on the mask of, I got this, when we don't. Because then when we do say, I got this, people will believe us and they will trust us based on how we've acted in previous situations.
Yeah. So, or if you never give them a shot, man, that psychological safety goes out the window. Because they're like, why should I give my answer or my thoughts when all he's going to do is choose his answer or mine anyway? And that just it erodes trust. It erodes the psychological safety. It erodes innovation. It's just negative across the board.
Agree. Totally. So now I'd like to get back to something I think I promised you like 45 minutes ago. We're going to circle back to your five why framework. My sailing experience is pretty much zero. I've been on some boats, but I've never had to drive them. I've got to relax and consume beverages on a few.
That's me too.
But I've never actually had to take controls of one. So when you talk about YAR, making things easier for people, I feel like in a lot of ways, that is an underappreciated role of leadership. You hear great leaders talk about removing obstacles and coaching and doing these things, but from your experience, how and why, well, actually, you know what? Screw it. This is your framework. You take it wherever you want. Why is it so important that we make things easier for those around us?
Yeah, I mean, change is already hard. And we know scientifically, most people do not enjoy change. There's going to be resistance, even if it's beneficial. So the first thing I want people to understand is that communication is doubly important when you're communicating change. So you have to really convey that message, not just once, but restate it multiple times in multiple different ways. So, for example, if I'm in an organization and I know a change is coming, whatever it is, I can communicate it through an email like that newsletter. I can communicate it, make sure the managers understand it so they can communicate what's coming down the pipeline, communicate how it's going to impact the employees or whoever's the stakeholders are. And you just want to make sure that you're doing that in multiple ways, following up multiple different times with letting them know and set timelines, like give them when this change is going to take place. Is it going to be a phased approach, which I recommend because you never want to do anything sweeping. So you want to start small and phase that change in. The other point is model the change. If you are a leader and you're saying this and you're not eating your own dog food, then no one is going to follow through. So model whatever that change is. If you want to change in the culture, if you want to bring in a new technology, use that technology. You create that change and model it. The other component is get feedback because you want to iterate. You don't want to say this is it and leave it at that. Get feedback as you're going through that change. That's going to make it so much better because I've seen a lot of orgs just push and force things on, and then it ruins everything. And now they got to spend money and time rolling things back. So you always want to make sure you have pivot points along the way the fourth component is you really want to, when you're coming into making things easier, you want to think about how you can delegate what's going on. Maybe you don't have to do it. Maybe your leadership team doesn't do it, but this is a great time to, again, give people that ownership and that opportunity to lead projects and lead components of it. So this is that. Like, this is a great time to find out who may succeed as the next leader in somewhere. So you want to make sure that you're giving those opportunities. You want to delay anything that is a part of that change that may not fit at the moment. Maybe it's a nice to have, but maybe it's a little bit too much for your team right now and they just can't handle it. Delay that, push that down the road. And you want to mark those things before you even start rolling out this change. What is a need to have? What's a nice to have? And what is a, hey, if things aren't going well, we're going to push this back. Or you can delete it to say, hey, this was something that we really wanted, but let's be honest, it's not going to fit here. Got to be able to delete. And then the fourth thing is you want to be able to automate as much as you can. So that way you're taking off those mundane tasks off the plate of people and giving them opportunities to really show their skill and be challenged by meaningful things. Because one thing we know is two things matter most to folks. One is meaningful work. And then the second is recognition. So the last part of that change is recognizing people along the way. You want to make sure that you're letting them know, we know that this change is tough, but we appreciate you doing a good job, taking it on as your own and doing whatever it is that you're doing in an excellent way.
Yeah, that recognition throughout is critical, not only because it makes people feel good, but it gives them the confidence to continue. Like, I have accomplished something. There was 100 steps on this journey. I'm 20 steps in. Okay, I'm going in the right direction. I'm doing the right thing. So that's critical on a lot of levels. And kind of some themes in there too. A big one that I think I picked up on is communicating the change and executing the process from the perspective of what your team needs, not what you want.
Yes.
All too often as leaders, this is what we want everyone to be able to do. This is what where we want everyone to be. This is how I want them to handle it. Well, they might not be capable. They might not be prepared. They might not be ready. They might not have the resources. They might have a different perspective. So that doesn't mean we can't get them to where we want them to be, where we want the process to be, but we've got to start with where they are as opposed to where we want them to be, which is can be two completely different places. And if we're not
see it all the time.
Yeah. And if we're not self-aware and if we're not being honest and if we're not getting feedback, it's going to be tough for us to tell that. And when we think about that process of change, often at a leadership role, we're given the change before we have to give it to somebody else. So we go through that grief cycle of, okay, it sucks. I don't want to do it. Well, I guess I have to. Here's the benefit. Okay, I'm in. And then we say, okay, I'm in, and then go give it to somebody who says, wait, this sucks. I don't want to do it. And then we get mad or frustrated with them because they're in a stage that we were already in. But somehow we expect them to have navigated this cycle at the same time we did when they didn't even know it was coming. So
that is so true, man.
All great points. You mentioned a lot of D words in there, but one in particular, I feel like a lot of people struggle with, and I've been guilty of this too, which is delegate. And I feel like sometimes we struggle delegating maybe because we're afraid that somebody won't do it exactly the way we want or how we want or when we want. And we can say we don't want to delegate because we have the most confidence in ourselves, but that translates to, I'm afraid other people can't do it the way I want when I want. So it's a fear-based response more often than not. How have you worked with individuals, leaders at any level to help them not only embrace the benefits of delegating, but improve how they do it?
Yeah, great question. And yes, delegation can be tough, especially when you're someone that you're just like, hey, I know that I can do this well. I have the skill set. Why not just do it myself? Well, if you do it yourself, it's taken away from something that's probably more important for you to be doing. So that's the first thing, right? Why do you think it's important for you to do this thing that actually should be delegated? And usually when I ask those questions, it's that fear-based response first. Then the second time they're like, yeah, maybe, you know, I could delegate a little bit of it. And then the third time they're like, you know what? I do need to start doing this other thing, right? Because that's more important for me. That's something I have to do. So that process, just getting them to see why it's important for them to actually delegate the thing and just start small, then it usually leads to them. And what I've found is a lot of times when you delegate a task is the person you delegate to actually does it better than you. I found that myself because I was one of those leaders who like, I'm not delegating anything. Right? I'm afraid that they might screw it up. Right? This is my brand here, or this is my word. This is my company. But I've realized that if you get the right person to delegate it to, they're going to find more efficiencies. They're going to do it better than you. And because they're focused on that task specifically, they have more time to optimize it. So that's one of the things I always tell leaders, like just give one task, start with one thing that maybe you just don't enjoy doing, but you felt like you had to do, but then you realize that it can be passed on. Once you start with that one thing, you'll start to feel that stress go off. You'll start to build trust with whoever you delegated to. Then you can give them another thing. So really starting small is the key to delegating effectively, where you're not like having a heart attack every time you pass something off. Because it's really a trust thing, like you said. It's fear-based, but it's also the fact that you're like, I don't know if this person is capable. So just give them a test project, something that wouldn't, you know, put the walls on fire if they didn't do it well. And then you also want to make sure that when you're delegating, you try to document the process as much as you can. Like, how did you do it? And then give them room to, like I said, optimize it and do it in their own way after a while, like once you build that trust. And I found that that really helps to both parties. So there's not ambiguity in there for them. And then for you, you can say, oh, what part of the process are you in? Okay, this is how I did it. Let's walk through it. And then just set up some time to check in with them to say, hey, how's it going? Are you running into any issues? Do you want to do a call? Maybe do you want to walk through it by a video or in person so we can make sure you get it? And that's it. You just want to make sure you're setting up time. You don't want to do it right when that thing is due. You want to do it ahead of time so you're proactive, so you're not rushing to get that thing done.
Back to milestones and strategy and feedback and communication. Yeah. This probably happens with you. I try not to laugh out loud, when I get a phone call from someone that says, you know, I just reached out to somebody on my team. This is due tomorrow. And now I find out, well, why are you reaching out to them a day before it's due?
Exactly. I'm like, what the hell are you doing, man? You had all this time. Like, you knew that it was due.
Yeah. Was this a surprise? Like, no, you've known for 2 months. Come on. I think in fairness too, like, I don't want to sound like being hard on people unnecessarily. Often as we're promoted in any organization, it is a technical or tactical competency that gets us promoted. So if I was good at something and that's why I got promoted to a leadership role, then it's even riskier for me to allow somebody else to do it, because this is why I got promoted to begin with. And if it's not done well, it's going to reflect negatively on me. So it's easy to understand that. But I love how you equated delegation to trust. And a lot of times when we work with leaders, you know, trust is based on evidence. So a lot of times when we work with leaders, it's how do you give people evidence that you're trustworthy? Well, now we can flip it. How do we allow other people to give us evidence that they're trustworthy? Well, we got to delegate. We got to give them something. And like you said, it can start small. It can be in phases. And then as they give us the evidence that they can handle it, we feel better. We can relax. We can position them to be successful. So I really like all of that.
Yeah, appreciate you.
As part of that five whys, you also talked about making or people who can be, wait, how'd you say it? Was it the yoga? So people who can have grace in difficult situations. And I might not be saying that exactly the way you did. How do you work with people to teach them how to maintain a graceful presence under difficult circumstances?
One is to slow down. So oftentimes, especially in crisis situations or what we think is a crisis, we speed up, we talk faster, we're like pressing. And what I've learned from some of the most adverse situations is that we need to slow down, take a step to assess what's really happening around you. Take a step, because if you move too quickly, you make the mistake, and that mistake could be catastrophic. So you want to slow down, think about process. What is happening? What moves can I make? And then see if you can identify next best option from where you are. All right. And think about maybe the consequences that may happen if you can really quickly. The second thing when it comes to that yoga and having strength is be proactive. a lot of organizations have gone away from tabletop exercises and really walking through certain situations that could arise and probably will arise at some point. What do we do in these situations? How do we handle it? Who's in charge? Who do we call? Do we have a call list? Like, all these things need to happen ahead of time. And I found that a lot of orgs just, they never do those types of things, never do planning exercises, never actually take their people and say, hey, we're going to spend a couple of hours just walking through. If this X thing happens, what do we do? Right? Because when you're proactive, if you train as you fight, as we say in the military, when that fight does arise, you're more inclined to work off of muscle memory, even if you are in panic mode. And that's what we want. Because if you're just reactive, everything you do is going to feel magnified. And when it feels magnified, that pressure starts to get to certain people, depending on your behavioral pattern, your behavioral type. So we want to default to something that feels familiar. And the third piece is, you know, being adaptable. So again, the outcome, being tied to the outcome, looking at the journey as lessons learned. All right, we fell short. What did we get from this? That after action report, again, can happen anywhere. It doesn't have to happen at the end of a mission. So we need to be willing to check in with ourselves to say, all right, what is going on? Right? What am I feeling? And then ask the team, what are they feeling? What are they seeing? What are they hearing? What are they doing? Right? From a team perspective, how are we holding one another accountable? Like, all these things need to be put in place ahead of time. And then another piece of staying flexible and strong and graceful in adverse situations is you have to prepare yourself mentally, emotionally, right? So you need to already have some type of routine that gets you in a space to say, all right, it's go time, right? I know the world's on fire around me, but how do I make sure I put myself in a space that I'm thinking clearly, that I'm concise? Or if that is not my natural default state, who can do that? Who is the person that seems to be cool, calm, and collected and able to see things in a way? Because it doesn't always have to be the leader, you know, by title. Sometimes someone else should be in that role and they're able to handle crises in a different way, or just handle when things don't go well a lot better. So we have to be willing, again, to be that humble leader to say, you know what? That's not me. I'm a person. I'm go, go, go. I'm ready to roll. I need someone else who's the opposite of me to go ahead and take charge in these situations. So those are some of the ways that I've worked with organizations to kind of make sure that they're in a better state than to be reactive, and they're able to like think clearly in those adverse situations.
All great answers. And before, I'm pretty sure you're not going to get mad at me for mentioning this, but if you do, I guess I can either hit the edit button or we'll figure it out.
Not at all, man.
But before I enter into my thoughts on it, you know, as we're talking to somebody who was talking about staying slow and staying calm and being reflective during what it either is real or a perceived crisis, you know, we're here having a conversation with you today and you've been awarded a Bronze Star. So your understanding of crisis and stress and difficult situations is on a different level than mine, because no matter what I think I've been through, I haven't been in a scenario that I would be in a position to be awarded anything like that. So I want to make sure we call out your experience specifically on this topic as we go through it. But I do believe that, and hopefully you're not mad at me bringing that up.
No, not at all, man. I appreciate it. I think it has clarity for the listeners. So they're like, cool. Who is this guy? What? There you go.
He's earned the right to talk about it. Let's just put it that way. The hard way. He's earned the right to talk about it. But as you did talk about, it's a lot easier to solve stressful problems before we're actually experiencing the stress. So if we're able to think through it, work through it, shop it, or workshop it in advance when it happens, either hopefully it's muscle memory or we can think through the practice reps when we deal with it. And especially as we look at businesses, you're right. It's whoever the person in charge might not be the person to lead the response or reaction or to whatever a quote unquote crisis might be. Maybe it's not the CEO. Maybe it's not the COO. Maybe there's a VP. Maybe there's a manager. Maybe there's a technical expert somewhere and they're the right person to tap on the shoulder in a certain situation and say, hey man, here's a bat. You're up. You know, you're the one for this. We support you 100%, but you are best equipped to lead us in this situation. And that's a level of self-awareness again. It's kind of rare to find, but very important right. When we have it. So all amazing points. You've you've done an awesome job throughout this conversation of tying together like words and phrases that I don't think often people see going together or would hear going together, if I'm using the right words here. But you talk about being strong and graceful. And I feel like a lot of times when people think about being strong, it goes back to that traditional, I'm in charge, do what I say, respect me, damn it, kind of approach. Like, and when you talk about being graceful, that's a little bit more flexible, a little bit more empathetic, a little bit more understanding. I think I can see it. Could you please walk us through how being strong and graceful work together and amplify each other?
Yeah. And that's, thank you for asking that and putting that together. So when I think of a strong and graceful person, not just a leader by title, but a person, they are humble because they understand that, hey, they're curious. They understand that they don't have to have all the right answers. They're confident in themselves. They are someone who can adapt to change. They're someone who doesn't get upset when things don't go their way because they don't personalize it. They process it. They are someone who's willing to engage in healthy conflict because they understand conflict leads to better ideas, better decision-making, better innovation if you do it correctly. They are not someone who is chastising someone for sharing the ideas. They're someone who will make room for other people's perspectives. And that's really strength, right? When you think of strength, you think about, again, emotional intelligence, someone who is very self-aware, who's very comfortable being themselves, but not so confident that they go into the level of arrogance, not so confident where they aren't willing to hear anyone else's opinions. And then they're able to manage themselves. If they do feel like they're getting upset or flustered, they're able to say, hey, I think we need to pause a little bit. I feel like I'm getting into a space where I'm not really hearing what's being said. So do you mind if we take a moment? Or they have a routine where they can break in place so that they can process things. You know, mine is four square breathing. I exhale everything out, breathe in 4 seconds, exhale everything out 4 seconds, and then do that all over again until I'm calm. So they're able to understand that. What are my triggers? What are my biases? Where do I feel like I get into a space where I'm not able to operate on that calm level? And what do I do when I get in that situation? Because that's most important. They've already prepared all of that stuff. And then they're able to step in with empathy because, again, they're able to say, I don't need to have all the answers. I have all these excellent people who serve in a level of excellence in their particular fields. They have different experience than me. I think we should leverage that to be better as a team because we know we move further, faster together. And then that last piece is the relationship management. They don't want everything to just benefit them. They want it to benefit mutually. They want the group to benefit from whatever that decision is. And once you can get that, you know, grace and strength become synonymous.
We're going to end on that line. Grace and strength become synonymous. That was awesome. We're going out on a W. Man, what a conversation. I really appreciate all your energy. I appreciate all your insight. I appreciate how you wove all this together for us. Thank you very much. For people that are taking a deep breath right now, checking over their notes, they're thinking, how do I get his books? How do I hear him speak? Where do I connect with Jevon? Please walk us through. Where can people connect and learn more with you?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, man, thanks for having me on this podcast. Excellent conversation. You are phenomenal at what you do, Michael. Really appreciate the questions and the dialogue that we had. If people want to connect with me, you can go to JevonWooden.com, J-E-V as in Victor, O-N-W-O-O-D-E-N.com. You can get my books there. You can contact and message me. You can connect with me on socials. So that's the place to go.
Awesome, man. And I'll pull all those links out. I'll put them in the show notes so people don't have to go hunting around for them. They can find them right there. Man, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you. I can't thank you enough for spending an hour with us and all that you've shared with us. I really appreciate it. I don't know if you saw, I've been taking notes the whole time you were talking
to.
So I really appreciate everything you brought to us today. I really look forward to staying in touch. Stay safe, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Jevon, thank you for a great conversation. I appreciate all the energy. I appreciate all the insight. I appreciate you weaving the military and civilian world together. Thank you for being open about parts of your story. So much to learn there. I took a bunch of notes. I really appreciate all that you shared. Just to try to pick up a few highlights. Now, you talk about slowing down to assess the situation. Very important. Often we can go faster by slowing down, even though that feels counterintuitive. I was really intrigued by the conversation talking about combining being strong and graceful. I thought that was very interesting. And I love how you said, don't personalize it, process it. All words of wisdom. I really appreciate you sharing your time today. Thank you so very much. And of course, thank you to all of you for being here for another episode. We appreciate you sharing another hour of your time with us. Hopefully you took a bunch of notes and gained many new perspectives from listening to the conversations as well. Thank you. Before you go, please take a second, like the show, share it, subscribe it, leave us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. What would you like to hear more or less of? Please let us know. And while you're online, check out our sponsors. Head over to humantel.com. That's where you can develop the skill set of understanding what people are likely thinking and feeling at any moment in time by accurately evaluating changes in their facial expressions and body language to pick up on shifts in their emotions. While you're there, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice. For the professional interviewers, head back over to certifiedinterviewer.com. Get all your questions answered about the International Association of Interviewers and the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you earn the designation? What could it mean for your career and more? And finally, while you're online, please head over to INQUASIVE.com. That's where you can explore the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more, as we teach them how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences every day. We appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so very much. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.